me tell you of the days of high adventure.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm John.
And this is 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger, the podcast where we take a long, hard look back at some of our favorite action movies from the era of Arnold's.
You guys, Schwarzenegger is the icon of the genre, and we're taking a deep dive into some of these 80s and 90s cult action movies and breaking them all the way down.
Do my best Clancy Brown impersonation.
Yeah, I was about to say, are you sure that Christopher Lambert isn't the icon of the genre?
I'm the icon of the genre.
That's a good impression, dude. Well, I don't know what accent that is.
It's
That's
creepier.
Not what Swiss people sound like either, or no. French people.
He's unidentifiable.
He probably thinks that's his American accent.
What the fuck are we even doing here? You guys,
oh my God.
Let us first of all just apologize to you for getting out of hand. I'm John. That's Kevin. We've got our friend Andrew Miller here.
He's in trouble.
Houston joining us. Yeah, baby.
A resident Highlander expert.
And yeah, we're here to talk about Highlander, a movie that if you've listened to the first episode, you'll know that Kevin and I had never seen before we started preparing for this show.
Yes. Somehow, some way, because it was, like you said, it was in the ether.
Yeah.
It was like, I was aware that people like this. There was the TV show.
Yeah.
Was also around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. With Adrian Paul. Is that the guy?
I was going to ask if you'd watched either of you.
Who is he? An offspring of?
I think he's another cousin.
Okay, sure.
Can it run in the family?
It runs in the family.
You can't have children. As a Highlander, as we will, immortal in this, as we will learn.
You cannot procreate, or you just should not.
I think you cannot.
Cannot.
That's what they say, but at the end of the movie, he says something about,
because
I can have kids.
Once he becomes the master of the quickening.
Oh, then he can fuck again?
Yeah.
He becomes the master of the universe.
That should have been, I always think of Highlander 2, the fuckening.
So, in the same thing that we'll probably talk about in today's episode, we learned that there are other immortals that just pop up out of nowhere, even though Connery told us at the beginning that they've existed since the dawn of time.
Right.
So we've got some paradox there. I don't know. Maybe they exist outside of time and inside
There's a
of time.
Lot of issues.
Who knows?
There's a lot of issues because it's like, first, how can you know about the gathering and know all these things if it's never happened before?
How do you know the name of every other Highlander?
How do you know that
I keep calling
Jesus
them Highlanders.
Christ is coming back one day?
I thought they were Highlanders before I started watching. Yeah. Then I was just like, oh no, he's just a dude from Scotland.
Yeah, yeah. I always thought, I was like, well,
there can be only one Highlander.
I was like, that's a cool ass title.
It's much better than we don't really have a name.
Yeah.
We've been around forever. We never really got around to giving ourselves a moniker.
Yeah, we'll get into more of the lore as we get into the episode. So this is episode 2
of the series.
As we get
into the drinks.
That's right. Yes.
What are you drinking?
I've switched over to Castle and Key. So the first episode I was drinking that Uncle Pepper rye, which was
Old
delicious.
Pepper.
I said that. Old Pepper.
Old Pepper.
You never listen to me when I talk.
Old Uncle Pepper.
Old Uncle Pepper.
It's the same bottle we had when you were over last.
Ooh,
I'm not,
yeah,
not a big
good.
Rye drinker, but damn, it was better than I remembered.
Yeah, it was delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm drinking Castle and Key too. This movie has castles.
Yeah.
It
and
does.
Keys sure. at one point. What's sure. her name tries to get into her apartment?
Keys of cocaine.
We didn't have any scotch. We wished we did, but
next
we're drinking scotch and spirit.
What are you drinking over there?
I am drinking the Carbach Crawford Bach. It is baseball.
Oh, that's a killer name.
It is baseball season here.
I noticed it had the Astros stripes on it.
So,
oh, is that affiliated with the team? They got the real team logo?
Yeah. So at the juice box at Minute Maid Field, there are the Crawford boxes. Crawford is one of the streets that runs along, the left field wall, and they have some boxes out in the back. And so the Crawford boxes are that short home run porch in left field at the juice box, and Carbach, local Texas brewery, created the Crawford Bach, in affiliation with them.
But we're not here to talk about beer, unfortunately. We're here to, maybe unfortunately, we're here to talk about Highlander.
Yes. I'll try to catch us up on what's been happening in Highlanderverse.
Yeah.
It's still sort of mysterious what is actually happening, but we've been told by the disembodied voice of Sean Connery that there's basically like a race of beings that has been wandering among people from the beginning of time, that are all sort of whatever battling each other, I guess. So we've got this dude McCloud who exists in both present day 1985 and
1536.
Scotland. I said Connor McCloud. Yeah. So we've seen him sort of seem like he got almost killed.
Yeah.
In a battle in the medieval Scotland. He's also battled some dude in a parking garage of a wrestling match in 1985, lopped dude's head off and got captured by the police and arrested. There's a female forensics officer who's found this antique sword.
Which she identifies immediately.
Immediately. She didn't need to test the age of the metal or anything like that. She just knew exactly what it was. $1 million antique sword. And this dude, McCloud, happens to be an antique dealer. So they think that's more than a coincidence.
Right.
And there's some evil bastard, like huge maniac warlord guy, yeah, who seems to want to kill McCloud for reasons we don't quite understand.
Correct.
Wearing a mythical creature skull as a hat.
He's wearing
exactly. Yeah. He's
wearing a humongous hamster skull as a hat.
The saber tooth hamster.
Saber tooth hamster.
Man, are either of you hip to the fact that we're about to get a new Willow series?
Yes.
I know that the trailer's out, right?
Yeah. It looks badass.
Are any of you hip to the fact they're, I think, rebooting Highlander?
What?
With the director of John Wick.
Ooh, that sounds awesome.
I'm intrigued. They haven't said who would play Highlander or anything like that. I think it's still really early, but I'm intrigued.
If nothing else, I'll watch it. At least a few episodes to give it a taste test.
Reboot something where there's room for, like, vast room for improvement.
Yeah, and there
like
is.
Like this.
Yeah,
big you know, time. Don't try to reboot Conan.
And this chick,
things that are
like,
good.
To its credit, I mean, it's got the germ. It's got a germ of something positive. It's got
obviously
a germ of something that you want to be in on.
Obviously, people are intrigued by the concept because it's been done and done and
it's
done.
It's ubiquitous.
Yeah.
So the action for this episode opens at a police station. A cop knocks on a window to communicate something to that featured asshole who was roughing up McCloud in the Madison Square Garden parking garage right outside.
They're just like dick flexing with each other, like staring
he's
each
like,
other down.
He's staring McCloud down, who at first is just staring straight ahead, but then he like turns to glare right back, and that look seems to give the dude pause because he's like, oh, okay, never mind, I didn't mean to do that. So someone comes in, which breaks the tension. It's Frank and Walt. That's the lieutenant who were like, and the detective who were like monitoring the scene.
He tripped over the decapitated body. That guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So Frank is carrying the sword that they found under the car that Brenda found, now in an evidence bag and some other shit.
They had a sword-linked evidence bag.
Thank God. It's what they keep bloody umbrellas in.
Yeah, do you think they just like took it and put it in the umbrella sack that's at the front door, and they were like, this is good enough. Tape it off. It's evidence.
Yeah, I don't get the feeling that Frank much cares about it. He's just like, ambling towards retirement. Uh-huh. So anyway, he sits, tosses a photo on the table, and asks McCloud if he's ever seen the guy in the picture. McCloud looks and shakes his head no. Frank says the guy's name is Wacilek. He's a Polish national who had his head cut off in Jersey two nights ago. He asks McCloud, you ever visit Jersey? McCloud's like, not if I can help it, which
not
is kind of funny.
Not if I can help
it. Yeah, not if I can help it. What? So, like, where are you from?
So I know it's supposed to be that like we're thinking that the quickening is like the gathering is happening and people are coming closer. I like to just imagine also that there was just a beheading that took place in New Jersey.
Random
and like,
beheading.
They're in looking new, for like, something, well, that, but it's like, oh, two beheadings. Well, it
happens.
Seems like it might be connected.
So asshole cop says to Nash/McCloud, you talk funny. And where are you from? And McCloud's like, lots of different places.
Yeah. Well, now is the time. Well, now is a time to just, what's the deal with that fucker's accent?
He's like, you know, I made him Southern. I don't know why. I think just because I think
no,
of
no,
cops.
The
it's impossible
the
to
cop
say
sound
it.
Came off like a Southern. Oh, you got a pretty mouth, boy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like that shit. But what's up with Lambert's voice?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
It's just an indiscernible.
Lots of different places.
Lots of different places.
So in some ways, I think it makes sense. Like, you could retcon that to be like, you know, he's from all different places, and his voice is going
to
change.
His accent has faded over the centuries, right? Like, to just this generic combination of whatever. Because I think when they're in medieval Scotland, he's trying to do a Scottish accent.
Yeah.
Terrible. So it's bad, but
I think there's also the question that linguists would pose if, like, what Scottish people sound like today is probably not what Scottish people sounded like 500 years ago. And so maybe the accent he has is a 500-year-old Scottish accent. I mean, it's bullshit for this movie. It's stupid. Like, that's too much thinking. But, like, they think that people in, like, the Appalachian Mountains have the accent that Shakespeare had because they were isolated for so long that, like, they think that they probably carried that a lot longer than the rest of the English did.
I've seen that story too. Yeah, it's interesting to think about.
We know we don't know, and we'll never know.
We'll never know.
Because we can rest assured that Christopher Lambert was not making a conscious choice to sound any type of way.
And this is all of the lip service that gets paid to why does he talk the way he talks.
So Frank says, "You're an antique dealer, right?" And McLeod just says, "Mm-hmm." And Frank puts the sword on the table and asks what it is. McLeod takes a long look and says, "A sword?"
That was pretty funny.
It's pretty, yeah.
A sword.
And then asshole cop tells McLeod, "Wise up, smart ass." So Frank tells us that something we already know, it's a Toledo Salamanca broadsword that's worth about $1 million. And McLeod's like, "So what?" And Frank says, "I've got a theory that Nash McLeod went down to the garage to buy the sword from this guy who..." He tries to bait him into saying the guy's name. McLeod's too smart and's like, "I don't know the guy's name." And Frank then says that the guy was Iman Fazil and that he and McLeod fought over the sword and that McLeod decapitated him. McLeod's like, "Heh, heh, heh." He's like, "My theory is that Fazil was so upset by the lousy wrestling that he cut off his own head," which is, that's kind of funny.
And then the detective like thought that shit was hilarious.
Yeah, Walt was eating that shit up.
Well, and they've made the assumption that this sword here was involved, I think. Like,
right.
His head comes off. They find a sword. There's no blood on it.
Right.
It could not have been the weapon. And so, like, that part always irritates me a little bit of, like, this is not the murder weapon. So, like,
right.
Maybe he tripped and chopped his head off on a car bumper. Who knows?
What is that? What movie is that from? He's like, he fell and cut off his head shaving or something like that. Like,
no.
It's from some movie. Anyway, so yeah, Walt giggles and that annoys Frank. He's like, that's not funny. So then asshole cop, and he asks McLeod if he's gay, to which McLeod responds, "Why, you cruising for a piece of ass?"
Yeah, the whole shit turns real homophobic.
It's like, ooh. Yeah, so asshole cop gets in McLeod's face and gives him his theory, which is that McLeod went down to the garage for a BJ and he didn't want to pay for it, which it's like all of this shit's like weirdly homophobic. Like, it's just,
it is.
It's like ramps it up real quick and it's like, it's supposed to be super, super taboo. And then McLeod tells the asshole cop that he's like, "You're sick," which the dude just like decks him, just punches him in the face. Like,
he did.
That was a bridge too far. Don't tell me I'm sick.
Do not tell me I'm sick.
So they wrestle around for a sec. Walt tries to break it up, but then McLeod punches him backwards.
Again, dude, McLeod's just swinging the door wide open for the police to just fucking straight kill him.
Well, in just a moment, too, he's going to say something along the lines of, "Am I under arrest?" He should be now after he struck the cop.
Like, yes.
Yeah, assaulting
an
officer.
Even if the other guy, even if this dude Garfield started it, like,
yeah.
He did just punch the other guy, Walt or whatever, for no proper reason.
Yeah, so these shenanigans have gotten the attention of fucking everyone in the precinct. Like, the crooks are all looking cops are all looking
There's
in.
No way you just let this guy walk out after that.
He's fine. Let him go. He's clean.
Apparently, this precinct is only sex workers, though, because it's all, women wearing, star-shaped sunglasses and sequiny things and, just applauding him, and they're,
hookers and Johns only. This is the hookers and Johns precinct. Yeah, I also get the feeling that most of the stuff that happens in this movie happens in a very, consolidated area between Madison Square Garden and Chelsea, his antique store is on Hudson. It's like everything is within a 20-minute walk of each other.
What is that? Hell's Kitchen? You think
Madison Square Garden is Hell's Kitchen-ish, and then his office is supposed to be like Hudson Street is in Chelsea. So,
well, that's what I mean. Like, did they choose for the gathering Hell's Kitchen and we just never, funny. They never that's said good. It.
Well, who chooses where the gathering happens?
Yeah, that's a great point. It's like, who the fuck knows?
There's higher power or something.
It's like never explained that. Yeah. It's like, has this been handed down since the dawn of time and then it gets lost and then picked back up that it's supposed to happen at an exact moment in history? Anyway,
we'll never get the answer.
Yeah, we'll never know.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay. Like, I'd rather them not try to explain it and make it stupid, which is why the second movie was so bad. Than like, just let me shut up and enjoy the Die Hard.
Shut up and enjoy the Die Hard. Exactly. So Frank pushes McCloud back. He's like, hey, am I under arrest or what? And Frank's like, no, not yet. So McCloud's like, we're through. And then Frank, as McCloud's leaving, Frank says, oh, we're just getting started.
Yeah.
So cut to some aerial photography of New York at night. A voice on a radio is describing the garage murder, saying the victim hasn't been named yet. So we see a giant land yacht-ish car driving down the street and inside someone wearing some very 80s glam rock wardrobe. He pops a tape in the tape deck and is like, I know his name. And that's the unmistakable voice of Kurgan, who has also traveled to the future, we see.
Oh, yeah. I love it. He's become a big Queen fan.
Yeah, he's a huge Queen fan. The song is Give Me the Prize and It Fucks.
Yeah, he likes that
there's
one.
That guitar solo from Brian May right up top is awesome.
Nice.
They've chosen very different sartorial and aesthetic paths, the Kurgan and McCloud.
Like, yeah, definitely.
Kurgan Highlander 100% dresses. Kept the punk look through all time.
And Highlander's dressed like John Tesh or someone who would like listen to easy listening music or something. You know what I mean?
That's exactly what he's dressed up as.
He fucking loves Michael Bolton.
Yes, yeah. He definitely does.
Maybe not musician John Tesh, but Entertainment Tonight John Tesh.
Yeah, he's into it.
Are either of you familiar with this guy listens to music that my parents listened to in the late 80s, early 90s. Like people like KT Osland. And if you're not familiar with that name, go look up KT Osland and an artist named Basia, B-A-S-I-A. And that will clue you. That was some like soft rock pop shit. I mean, it was like lady yacht rock is what I call it. Yeah. Ooh. So, I mean, it's that kind of stuff. And that's what Nash looks like he listens to. So, yeah, but this song is harder than most Queen songs, as we've talked about. So we cut to Kurgan checking into a motel under the name Victor Kruger.
Which I was trying to figure out, is there some significance to the name?
And I wondered too.
Somebody was saying they thought it was like the writers thought they were being clever, that Victor is like the winner, like, right. And Kruger it means warrior. But okay. They were saying, then they said Krieger means warrior, and Kruger is like someone who makes jugs. So I don't know if they meant.
It wouldn't surprise me if these writers didn't do their due diligence.
No, not at all. A little sloppy.
It. Yeah.
Close enough.
Yeah, so this is the first time we see him not decked out in his skeleton armor, and he's in like a very severe looking motherfucker.
And he's got this huge scar across his throat, which we're like, where did that come from? We'll find out.
He's got his throat slit at some point. The motel doesn't appear to be very nice. The desk clerk looks a little worse for wear, like he's coked up out of his mind, and there's a dude in a chair just like smoking and drinking beer.
That dude cracked me up.
Yeah, he tells Kurgan, the desk clerk does, that he's going to need $20 in advance, and Kurgan slips 20 out of a wad of bills, and that perks the desk clerk's interest, and he's like, oh shit, you know, let me know if you need some blow or a hooker, like I got your back, like just dial zero.
Okay. Where did Kurgan get the dough and the money and everything? Did you see like steal it from somebody killed?
It's a funny thing that I just saw today, some tweet thread where someone was like, how do vampires have so much money? And I think that it's like when you're alive long enough, you just know,
long-term investment, man.
Yeah, you figure out how to play the game and steal people's money, you steal people's shit and sell it or whatever, and you can't die. So it's just like, that's just the way it is.
I saw a tweet the other day that had said, like, you know what, if I was a vampire, if I was that vampire in Twilight that was hundreds of years old, I just wouldn't enroll in high school.
Right? Where else is he going to meet chicks, though?
Meet young babes, meet young nubile women.
I got to meet my vampire baby mama, I guess.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I think that like the Kurgan definitely steals people's money. Like we learn later on that like McCloud has made long-term investments and has a strategy for making his own money. But
most likely Kurgan killed the guy in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. The other beheading victim, we would assume, right?
He's out
there probably leaving a trail of bodies in his wake.
That's the thing, too, is that, like, so Kurgan's out there killing people. What happens to an immortal's body when they die? Because we definitely know that
Fazil's
he gets involved.
Was still there.
Okay, so it's still there. So the body is still there. So it emits its quickening,
yep.
Which the other immortal absorbs, we guess. The shell is left there. Okay, so he's out and about in the Tri-Cities
cool
area.
It'd be cool if the body sort of like
shriveled,
decomposed, you know, because it's thousands of years old, right?
What's happening to me?
Yeah. He chose poorly.
He chose poorly. So the dude, I love that the drug dude of the chair gives us a weird. He's like Lucky Strike tobacco commercial.
There's your product placement.
It's like that's the first. It's like it's like this
Lucky
is
Lucky Strike means fine tobacco.
Yeah, we got that close up Coke can at the beginning where he stepped
that's
on
true
that.
True too. Yeah, that's true too. And the cork's like, hey, don't talk to guests.
That was such a weird moment that I loved in the movie
because
it was just interesting. It appears to be the one and only film appearance of Prince Howell, who was that dude in the chair, the black dude.
I would love to know his story. Like, was he
Mr. Kruger, Lucky Strike means smooth tobacco. Whatever. What? Like, what the fuck?
Huh?
Huh?
So we cut to Kurgan's room where he's unpacking, and he opens a suitcase revealing his sword, which requires assembly. It's not a full Tang blade, we guess. Which is surprising to me that this motherfucker's like, why would he be cautious enough to have a blade that needs disassemblage?
Well, that's just not what you want in a sword either. Like, that's
fucking
terrible design.
Yeah, it's going to come apart.
It's going to break in the middle of a fight.
It's going to rattle in your hands.
Yeah. It doesn't
seem...
You
want one solid piece of metal.
It looks fucking cool, though.
Yeah, and I think that the only thing about it is that it's like... Something that people are like, oh shit, yeah, look at that fucking sword. It comes
put
apart.
It together.
That's badass. And again, it's like every movie that we talked about, it's like you get to dress your G.I. Joe, or here's your G.I. Joe's fucking
Well, if you're a Highlander though, if you're an immortal, don't you want to be ready for battle at all times? Not like, hold on, let me put my sword together.
No, time out here. I gotta put my sword together.
We're all fine here now. Anyway, but yeah, I thought that was I thought that was weird. I did think though, when he starts like whatever practicing around the room,
he's like doing a montage.
Clancy
a montage.
Brown had some pretty sweet moves.
Yeah, I would say of all the moments in the movie where I would believe that anyone kind of had some training as to what they were supposed to be doing with the blade, this is the only scene in the movie where I was like, okay, he's practiced.
Yes, right? Someone he's worked with, someone's trained him.
Yeah, and it's unsurprising that it's Clancy Brown, because I kind of get the feeling that he's a guy that probably goes for it. Like, he's one of those kind of actors.
Yeah. He straight up refused to be in the second movie because he read the script and it was so bad that he was like, no, you can't pay me enough money to do this.
Oh, wow.
So,
good for him.
Like, I think he was like, I'll do shit for money and I'll do great stuff for nothing. And he considered this to be something that was like worth doing for a low paycheck because... At least according to what I was reading.
Oddly enough, Sean Connery's standards were not as high as he was like, I'm there. I'm in there.
Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe at this point in his career, he kind of, because later on in his career, Connery was noted for saying like, I only take jobs that like, if I read the script and it's something that I want to do. And I wonder if he read this and was like, and then I wonder how much stronger it would have been if a stronger actor had played the Highlander.
Oh yeah, it could have been good in the when you're reading the script and then you're like, oh, you're putting me with this fuck, like this novice.
And then Connery had probably already said, yeah, I'll do this, because it was that time. He was late in his career.
I don't know who would have been the man to play that part better, but they were out there, that's for sure.
Definitely out there,
you'd think. Yeah,
they had to have been. But anyway,
Harrison Ford could have played this and done he did a Scottish accent in fucking Last Crusade.
The tapestries.
If you are Scottish law, then I am Mickey Mouse. So anyway, yeah. So unsurprisingly, Clancy Brown looks like he knows how to handle himself with a sword. During all this, he stops to stare at his sword and he's like, at last, the gathering. Then flicks a switch and two additional little surprise blades pop out of the crossguard.
It's like that, I want that Wolverine sound effect. What is the one?
Snick, 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 snick.
That's where Kylo Ren's lightsaber idea came
from.
Yes,
exactly. That's exactly right. So he is so jazzed about whatever the gathering is that he appears to have ordered some companionship for the evening. And this is the most 80s looking prostitute ever.
Yeah.
And she has come calling. And if you pause, and I love this attention to detail, that if you pause it when she is like standing in the doorway, she's got like fingerprint bruises on her arm. And I was like, damn, that's
dark. I noticed that too. And I was like, is that just, is that's that dark. Was that real or was that great production design?
I think that that was production. Andrew, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I do think that she was a freebie. I think that the guy at the front desk sent her up because he asks about her later on. So I don't know necessarily if the Kurgan orders a prostitute for himself.
Send me your finest whore.
He definitely seems like the kind of guy who doesn't pay for it if he can take it.
The guy said, just call, like anything you need, call me. So maybe Kurgan did call down and send say, up, like, all right, send her up.
Candy. She was kind of had it going on. The actress who did the role was named Corinne Russell, and she was like a video vixen. She was like in all these hair metal music videos, I think, which the director Mulcahy like lived in that music video world. He probably had worked with her or something.
I was going to say that looks like the kind of woman slept with every member of Motley Crue.
Definitely. Well, I love that she didn't knock. She just opens the door because this is that kind of hotel. She just comes right in. And I love the shot of like the split screen thing of like Kurgan's eye in the foreground with her like blurred out in the background. Yeah. That was some very cool work. And she's like, yeah, hi, I'm Candy. And he says, of course you are.
Of course you are.
So she closes the door and one can only imagine what happens from there. He's going to kill her.
She's dead, man.
And we'll talk about this later, but I was like, well, she's dead. We'll never see her again. So we cut back to the police station where Brenda is checking something out under a microscope. A lab tech comes in and tells her that the coroner found pieces of metal in the dead guy's wound and on his clothes. Cut to a dot matrix printer slowly spitting out some numbers and figures, science and progress. And Brenda's like, that can't be right. Like, takes one look at something, absorption, whatever, 2 point whatever, blah, blah.
For now, we're left wondering what it is she's seen. But,
It's like the science is wrong for Brenda.
Do we think that there's any sort of computer-aided metallurgy that is happening in the forensics department of New York City?
Yes.
There's no database.
You put the metal fragments in, and this thing spits out how old it is, how many times the metal was folded.
Oh, I see.
How many times the metal was... It's fucking insane.
I mean, at best, you could probably like blast it with some light and get a... like maybe that's what it is of like absorbance is like how
some,
much like, it
yeah,
reflects.
Some remote
but,
sensing.
Like, the amount of detail that she gets in the script later on about like folded metal and those kinds of things are just absurd.
The exact year it was made.
Yeah, it's bullshit. We can all agree on that. So we get another cut and we see that McCloud has returned to the garden to get his sword from whatever the fuck that hiding spot was, some lighting picture or whatever.
I would have thought there would still be police presence there. Like, is this like the next night?
I would. Everything moves very fast in this movie, right?
Yeah.
Honestly, McCloud's dressed exactly the same. He is even later on after this scene that had me wondering, like, I think he's not been back home.
Right. Just as he pulls the sword down, we hear footsteps and see a flashlight beam. And if you thought it was going to be Brenda, you're right.
I would also think Brenda would have gone with a police escort. I don't think she just wanders in by herself with a flashlight.
Yeah. Nope. Not in 1985 New York, friends.
Yeah.
So McCloud ducks behind a pillar while Brenda makes her way over to the crime scene with a metal detector.
The big one you'd have at the beach. Yeah. You know?
I mean, that seems reasonable. Like, she knows she's looking for metal fragments.
That
like,
was state-of-the-art, probably, like, but does she just have that? Is that part of the forensics?
When you saw her silhouette coming down the ramp,
she was not carrying the metal detector.
She may have been carrying a big-ass bag with all the pieces that she would need to assemble.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, she puts that shit together and it starts to beep like crazy when she scans around the spot where McCloud got his blade stuck in the column after he chopped off a Fazil's head.
She gets there pretty quick. Like,
yeah, immediately. She's like, well, this is the kind
Let
of
me
area.
Check this concrete.
She's got
column.
Real good. Like, someone needs to check and see if she's an immortal because she's got a Peter Tingle herself. So she pulls out some shards of metal with some tweezers from the column and drops them in a file. And then a noise like a bottle being knocked over spooks her. So she's like, who's there? And like she like ducks out. I'm gone.
I guess that was McCloud again. Just is he clumsy or is he making noise on purpose?
I think he's making noise to like spook her. I think. So we cut to and I've been here, Peter McManus Cafe.
Oh, shit. That was like a...
That's a real thing.
It looked cool.
Peter McManus Cafe is an old school Irish pub that's been open since 1936 and is the oldest family-run bar in New York City.
A Scot would never go to an Irish pub.
Right? They'd be like, fuck this shit. So... This was another moment.
Unless he was stalking the forensics officer.
Yeah, he follows Brittany. Which he was. Fair enough.
But they have a big ass neon bud sign in the window.
Okay.
Yeah. So some product placement. But it makes sense that she's there because I checked it and it's a 15-minute walk from Madison Square Garden.
Nice.
So it's in the neighborhood.
But it's also her neighborhood where she lives, apparently, because that's her regular spot.
But then I was like, I've been to that bar.
That's
so
cool.
Which is kind of badass. Yeah.
Love that.
So inside, Brenda seems to be a regular and to have just arrived because the bartender like immediately knows her by name and is like, do you want the usual? And she's like, yeah, lots of it. And so he brings over a bottle of Hennessy and a
snifter.
Is that
what it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he brings her some Hennessy and pours the snifter almost to the top until she's like, that's enough. And in the background, someone has entered and we hear McLeod's voice order. And this is egregious. We were talking about this before we started tonight, but he orders a double Glenmorangie, which is a single malt, but he wants it on the rocks.
I'm not that into the Scotch scene.
It would never happen.
So you would never always drink it neat?
You drink it neat or you drink it with a drop of water. And at most, somebody would say, like, if you're going to do an ice cube, it'd have to be like the tiniest ice cube.
Okay.
Just to open it up, just to like let it breathe. But it's like adding anything to a single malt to apparent like most like professional Scotch drinking types is like sacrilege.
Okay.
You don't do that. You're supposed to enjoy it. So for this man who is allegedly from Scotland to order a single malt. So anyway, then McLeod's like, just to no one in particular, go to the garden often.
Yes, he was. Yeah. Full creep mode.
Both the bartender and Brenda like whip around and are like, what'd you say?
What? Huh?
And he's like, who, me?
There was weird sound design stuff happening in this because, it was a lot of overlapping dialogue like a fucking Robert Altman movie or something.
Yeah, and he plays dumb like, I didn't say anything.
For being the hero of this movie, like, he's a piece of shit for the whole, like, beginning. Like, he seems so, like, he's miserable at a wrestling match, which, like, how can you be miserable at a wrestling match? Wrestling is awesome.
If you're not a fan of wrestling, what are you doing there?
Yeah. Don't go bring it for everyone else.
Was there.
Yeah.
But was like, Fazil there because he's a big wrestling fan?
Oh, yeah.
I thought Fazil found him there because he loves to go to the wrestling matches.
Yeah.
Because he asks her later, like, don't you go to the circus or wrestling?
That's so weird. Yeah. That's so weird.
But, like, he's a piece of shit then. He's kind of an asshole to the cops, which is fine. Like, they arrested him, and that's what you're supposed to do. But then, like, he's kind of being a creepy asshole here to her.
He's extra creepy in, like, this scene.
He's fine. He's gotten his sword back. He's taken his evidence. He could just leave her alone. And he pursues her in a way that is not okay.
That's a great point. I did not even think about the fact that at this point, there's no reason to follow her.
What's his
her.
Game? Yeah, what's he after here?
He fell in love with her instantly.
He's down to plow, man.
Yeah. So
that's the first time he saw her, right? Was her entering the parking garage.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He's just like
Thunderstruck. Yeah. So anyway, whatever he said got Brenda's attention. She walks around the bar to him. She leaves her last swallow a cognac, though, which I didn't appreciate. I was like, damn, girl. So she's like, hey, what the fuck did you say? And he says, Madison Square Garden. Do you go there often? And she's like, why do you want to know? And asks if he's been following her. Uh-huh. And he says, I'd like to walk you home, Brenda. And I'd be like, the fuck? Why do you know my name?
Menacing stare down after. And I was like, if that shit had worked, I would have had to like reevaluate my whole approach with women. Because that shit could not have been more threatening.
Yeah, she doesn't ask Stranger Danger how he knows her name.
She seemed like she was considering it.
Yeah.
Like, I can take care of myself. I guess not.
Did either of you notice the creepy source of light blasting into the windows in the middle of the night?
Well, I think that happens a lot in this movie, like the lighting and
there's
and
a lot
DP
of bold,
stuff.
Like, it's like bold cinematography,
like large, like big time backlit shit. It's like everything is backlit.
Yeah. Something's going on out, like the fucking Batman spotlight shining in through the window.
I don't know if they were like going for some sort of neo-noir kind of thing, like in the bar.
That's what I thought.
And like, but it doesn't have the feel for the rest of it, except for some of those like egregious and bold lighting choices.
There are scenes
choices.
Where they're like going fucking full Blade Runner on these scenes.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
like you're conspicuous lighting
yeah.
in some
and,
scenes.
And this was the first time in 1985 that I was like, his hair length keeps changing. It's already changed from the parking garage to this bar. And
he
it's like,
stopped off for a quick haircut.
It's like sometimes it looks a little tighter, and then other times it looks a little messier. And it's like, what is happening? So
maybe you have particularly productive follicules as an immortal.
Maybe so. Like, maybe
every,
so.
Every 45 minutes to an hour, you need a haircut.
Yeah, that's a great point. So he pounds his double single malt whiskey with ice, apparently, and then steps outside the pub looking around warily, puts on his isotoners.
We got Freddie Mercury singing about being a prisoner of love inside you. Which is fucking, that sounds uncomfortable.
Yeah. It sounds like what it's supposed to sound like.
Yeah.
You got that tight booty.
Aren't we all?
So, however, Brenda, who's left the barge like just around the corner, like watching him leave.
Now she's stalking him. The hunter has become the hunted.
That's right. So as he walks away, McLeod slows for a moment as if, and this is the second time, he like feels a presence. It's like you can't tell what it is, but he's like, oh, and then he starts moving with a
presence I've not felt since.
So he starts moving with a quickness, and Brenda's following at a distance. He ducks around a corner into some kind of course, steamy industrial area, right. Vaguely industrial area.
They went yeah. from like Hell's Kitchen to, I don't know what this is, fucking RoboCop or something.
Or a nightmare from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
It's like we're in someone's nightmare. And like he's looking around like something's wrong. It's the face that he makes for 95% of this movie. Brenda's still following at a little bit of a distance when suddenly a hand reaches out, covers her mouth, and pulls her off the street. And it's, of course, it's McLeod who tells her, shut up.
Straight from the Schwarzenegger playbook.
Yeah, it's like,
grab like, a woman
I'm
and tell
here
her
to help you. Calm
grab
down.
A woman and tell her to shut up.
You dumb woman. I'm here to help you. I'm a strong man. But it's too late because a creepy, smiling Kurgan is there, motherfuckers.
He pops up out of what would have been plain sight
right.
for them.
Yeah. Right. Same as Fassel. Fassel does the same thing. Like they fucking apparate and
he's like, he would have been crouched. He would have been crouched at their feet and they didn't see him.
Kurgan takes a swing with his collapsible sword. But McLeod and Brenda duck out of the way in time. Sparks fly, which is great. So we know it's magic. They run toward whatever the steaming pipe setup is that's out there in Chelsea. Brenda falls down. McLeod picks up a rope and starts swinging it. I can't tell in the dark if there's something attached to the end of it or if you just swing it a length of
rope.
Rope. Like, okay, great.
I couldn't tell what.
What and a it's fucking like, moron.
And it's like boat rope also. Like it's yeah. it's like 4 inches thick. So it's like huge. But like of all the items to pick up as a weapon around you, like why pick the rope?
Well, yeah, every movie you're going to find like a piece of pipe or some chain or some rope just lying around.
He availed himself well with the forced entry tool. Like that was the only time that he's fought with any skill was when he had the fucking pipe. So I'm like, man, maybe you should change to bow staff because you should rethink your method.
While they're in the exact same area, so they haven't gone very far, the Kurgan stabs the shit out of that water heater looking thing a few times and then he picks up a pipe. So the pipe was laying right next to the rope and he chose the rope.
They're within steps of one another, but McLeod's like, no, this rope is the thing.
The rope
this
will
is
do
the,
it.
This is the thing. I can, and he knows I can decapitate someone with this. No,
that's like, yeah, what like, am I doing with
that's
this?
That's what
rope?
I'm saying.
This is useless to me.
This is yet another instant in this movie. It's like the rules are clear.
Doesn't he have his katana or did he lose it somehow already? He just got it from the garden.
Yeah, wait. Shit, did he knock it away? I can't even remember. He must have knocked it away.
I don't think he's had it out.
He took it from the garden. He never takes it back out. Like, he should be still
so he
carrying
is
it in theory,
unless he stashed it somewhere before he went in the bar.
He sprinted back to Nash Antiques and then ran back to where she was going
to
be.
To prey on Brenda.
That's fucking so weird. So anyway.
So when I take her back to my place, I can't have a katana on me.
Is that a sword in your pocket?
Is that a 4-foot katana in your pocket?
Certainly is. Yeah. Wait a minute. Has that been folded 200 times? You bet your booty. So McCloud takes off into the sprawling industrial complex with Kurgan
in
just
the
behind.
Middle of Manhattan somewhere.
Yeah. He inexplicably stops, as people are wont to do in this movie, and turns to face Kurgan again.
Mm-hmm.
Kurgan swings and misses, as everyone in this movie is wont to do with their swords and close-range weapons. McCloud starts letting him have it with the pipe, which, again, I'm like, this is your weapon, my guy. You are skilled with a bow-length weapon.
You just bash him till his head falls off.
Exactly. So the blows he deals, Kurgan seem to have little effect because Kurgan catches the pipe and then hits McCloud with it several times. Kurgan picks McCloud up and then tells him it's nice to see him again. McCloud says, it's nice to see you too. And Kurgan slams him a couple of times into a radiator or water tank or some damn thing. And then Brenda runs up through the steam and yells, stop! Kurgan smacks McCloud in the face and again says, there can be only one. Kurgan picks up his sword. McCloud jumps back with the pipe and yells, no! And then clocks. There's like all of this choreography is like, I don't understand what's happening.
It is this mayhem. It's like incoherent
he
mayhem.
He clocks Kurgan with it a couple of times. As they start dueling for real now, a helicopter shows up out of fucking nowhere.
Out of nowhere. Yeah. Where are these cops coming from?
And a voice over a loudspeaker says, you, on the ground. Just yes. Like this. And I'm like, hey, you, on the ground. This is the police.
Hey, guys. Okay. What are you doing?
Exactly. It's like, what you got? What are you buddies up to? Tells them to put down their weapons and put their hands in the air. It's like, how the shit did the cops even know they were there?
They were there instantly.
And then Kurgan again is like,
there's some guys sword fighting over there. Send the helicopter.
Yeah. What? So Kurgan's like, another time, Highlander. And
again, he just runs off for no reason.
Yeah, it's like, I'll find you. And so everyone runs off and the comically puzzled voice from the helicopter says, hey, hold it right there. Come on back here. What the?
Half this movie was like ADR'd. Like half the movie was recorded after the filming was done, I think.
Oh, man.
Hey, like, don't run
away.
It
was really bad later when we got Connery and Highlander together. Because I'm like, this is just dialogue that was shoehorned in after the fact.
Yeah, like this whole scene has felt so clunky. And again, like just Kurgan being like, all right, well,
that's where
I gotta go.
It feels like a canon movie.
Yeah.
I feel like canon. These dudes had their hands in this shit.
Yeah. Their fingerprints were all over it. I promised you their names aren't on it.
Yeah.
But they blew their wad all over it.
Oh, big time. So
their DNA is on it.
So out on the street, Brenda stops McCloud and is like, who the fuck was that? She also wants to know what the bad guy meant by Highlander and the phrase, there can be only one. She was paying very close attention from yards away.
Well, yeah. She's asking all the questions that we're asking ourselves
like,
as
yes,
viewers.
Please.
Like,
yeah,
we know
like, yes,
nothing.
Go
about...
on. But McCloud's like, shut up.
Shut up and go
and
home.
And never follow me again. Double standard.
Yeah, except that following... I followed you. That's why we're here.
Yes. It's like, what is what? So as he turns to leave, the noise from a loud truck causes Brenda to whip around, and then we get like another one of those like fading through an object transitions, and we're back in Scotland in 1536. The badass priest who was like slitting people's throats in the battle in the first act,
the Judas priest, if you will.
Yeah, we'll call him Judas Priest from now on. So the Judas Priest, Mrs. McCloud, and McCloud cousins are all hanging out, looking unsettled and discussing how the real McCloud could have survived what was sure as shit a mortal wound.
Yeah, right.
At that time, there's no way anyone probably could have survived that without like infection setting in.
No chance. Yeah, that was like all types of organs were probably fucked up inside you.
So one of the things that always confuses me about this part of the movie is that he seems to have been fined for more than just like... he got up off of his deathbed that morning and like now they're at the pub. Like it seems like this has been going on for a little while and they've been discussing how much of a freak he is for surviving that stab wound.
I don't know, because based on everything else that happens in the movie, I got it, because they say it's like you were on your deathbed last night.
I do. I feel like it's supposed to be the next day, but yeah, they're talking about him like he's been up and around for a little while.
Yeah,
and probably if this had happened in real life, they wouldn't have all adjourned themselves to the neighborhood tavern to talk about it. They would be in like the kitchen.
Why would his wife
or
not
something
be at his side? Or
right,
whatever.
Exactly. It's like, why is she gossiping with the cousins?
Yeah, the two cousins would have been off somewhere else, being like, "How is he getting better?" And the wife still like sitting by his side or something.
We also get we get the feeling that his wife is not entirely like mentally settled. Like something's up with her.
I would never in a million years have thought she was his wife.
Yeah, I had no idea. This is the first time I've ever put that together.
I thought she was like the town whore or something.
Yeah, so that was like watching this movie for the first time and in this scene, which we're going to outline here in a second, I was like, she's a bad guy, right? Like Kurgan has planted her.
She's trying to bring about his death.
Right.
Very, very vehemently.
But then also it's like just very like super Christian Dark Ages like witchcraft bullshit. So anyway, the missus is quick to say that McLeod must be possessed.
Like, he's got the devil in him.
Yeah. And at that moment, a smiling McLeod enters the tavern or wherever they are, and everyone in the room's like, oh shit, and like turns around to stare at him.
But I've never seen people so unhappy that their friend has miraculously cheated death.
Yeah, like, it's the superstition vibe is strong. So
everything I know about the devil too means that he's gonna save people who should have otherwise died.
Exactly. So everyone in the room stops talking, like turns to stare at him, and he immediately gets like self-conscious. He senses the tension, slowly makes his way over to his compatriots, and he's like, hey, what's up? And Dougal, the brunette cousin's like, you being up and at him when you were almost dead the night before is putting everyone on edge.
Yeah.
And McLeod's like, would you rather that I was dead? Which is a fair question.
I feel like the answer is kind of, yeah.
And then his wife is like, well, yeah, you must be a devil worshiper because none of this makes sense.
She went from being like the horniest person on earth to wanting him dead pretty quick.
Well, she loves the Lord, so.
Yeah, this whole scene reminds me, I can't get it out of my head, of the scene where the pythons show up with the witch.
Yes, yes.
But like, it's got that whole,
she's got a wart.
Yeah. She turned me into a newt. It's got that feel. Feta?
Yeah. It's exactly what it feels like. It feels very Python-esque. So, a murmur runs to the tavern at this mention of like being in league with the devil, and someone tells wifey that you shouldn't say such shitey things. But then Dougal jumps up and is like, no. Yeah, he probably is in league with the devil. No, this makes sense to me, probably because he was banging the wife. And that would be an interesting plot point. Oh,
does that seem right to you for the time period? Like,
totally.
Would just be like,
totally.
Could it not just as easily be that this is a miracle from God?
It should be, because he's probably a devout Catholic or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
But anyway, McLeod is stricken, rightly, by all this and says, hey, we've been kinsmen. We're family for 20 years. And I'm like, wait, they're supposed to be in their 20s?
Yeah.
Wait, he's supposed to be in his 20s at the least.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone in this room is 40. So anyway, Dougal says that Connor McLeod was his kinsman, but I don't know what the fuck you are. And that's harsh, bro.
That is rough.
So there's more tittering in the tavern. Then McLeod walks over, kneels down next to Angus, who seems to be like the only level head in the room. And he's like, hey, bud, but like immediately gets told, it's like, hey, you should probably get out of here.
Yeah, right.
So McLeod says he ain't going nowhere, but then someone breaks a jug over the side of his head.
Instantly, someone was at the ready with the jug, like,
fuck, no, man.
Fuck this dude.
Fucking kill you. So
it's like a barroom brawl type thing.
The mob drags him outside and he is trussed up with an ox yoke and they're just beating the fuck out of
him. They definitely took the time to tie him up to that yoke rather than just beating his ass and like throwing him out of town. Why take the time to strap his arms to it?
Those fuckers were bloodthirsty, though.
I think that it's one of those things where they were probably gonna like probably draw him with that yoke, probably or something like that, and just getting like the first step of any bloodthirsty murder at the time was parading the asshole through town and pelting them with shit and rocks, and that's what's happening. So people take turns beating, kicking, throwing rocks. There's lots of Christ imagery at this point of him like carrying the cross beam. At one point he falls, they haul him up, and Dougal's standing there ready to get his licks in. But Angus, saint that he is, yanks Dougal back. He's like, you know, McLeod's our cousin. And this one crazy looking dude jumps in there and just starts headbutting McLeod over and over again.
There's so many headbutts in this movie. Wrestlers on the turnbuckle.
Yeah, right? So then Angus is like, hey, there's not going to be any burning today. Let's just let him go. Instead, we're going to banish McLeod. But then
there's a long silence.
Yeah, then Mrs. McLeod's like, fuck that. Let's burn him.
Fuck that. We got to kill him.
Let's kill him now. That's what I'm saying is, like, it would have been amazing if we'd seen some element of her also being immortal
or being corrupted and then Kurgan had
like used her as a pawn. Like, it would have paid that off more instead of her just being insane.
She just flipped on him.
Some explanation for like why she turned on him so quickly.
Right. So Angus is like, hey, can you walk? And McLeod's like, yeah.
Buddy, walk out of here.
Yeah, am I going to get up? So Angus is like, you know, get out of here while there's time. So McLeod says, I'm not going to forget this. And also, that's sad. Like, I wish that there had been some moment later in the movie where that had been paid off, because, man, Cosmo, great moment there from him, like with a sad smile and nod. Like, that, I wish that there had been something else there. Like, if McLeod had been able to visit Angus on his deathbed or something to pay that off, like, I'll never forget the kindness that you paid me, or you know, whatever.
That would have been a good scene to have later, and like visiting him.
Yeah. So we don't get that.
Nah,
fuck it.
We don't have time for that.
This movie's not that detailed. So he does not, however. He cuts McLeod free, because the next thing we see is McLeod like walking up the hillside away from the castle. The mob's like still, like, he's tied to that yoke.
He didn't take the yoke off.
He's like still like tied to the yoke. Fucking what?
Probably gotta be hard. Your hands are both tied. Like, how's he gonna get it off?
It's gonna be rough out there.
He's gotta go scratch it against a rock or a tree like a bear until it comes off.
This lasts on until the night, but I guess he finally gets loose, because we see him like looking sad and forlorn, like leaning against a rock.
It could also be years have passed.
That's also true.
Yeah.
That's also true.
The yoke rotted off.
The yoke rotted away.
He didn't need. So that's the thing too.
Does he have to eat?
He doesn't need to eat.
Does he? I don't know.
No, he doesn't.
Nah, it can't have been that long, because he would have been very. He wouldn't have been as confused later on.
Well, that's the thing too.
When Ramirez is explaining to him what's going on.
We get the point that they like. Physical harm can befall them. So he could emaciate to the point of being like just a skeleton, one would think.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
But you can't drown, I guess. I don't know. It's hard to know.
That's the thing, too. Is like, would you resurface like waterlogged and your blood vessels all burst and
shit? He's all underwater, like, I can breathe. It's like, well, probably not.
That's the thing, too.
He can't breathe. He's not a fish man, but like. It seems like his animus, whatever makes him immortal, is all that he really needs, and that will carry him forward. But like, why he's only 20 years old
there's
compared
no
to
rules.
Some of the others.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Well, I'm just talking about like the types of wounds and deaths they're able to sustain, because if one guy gets his throat slit and bears a scar forever, and then you drown and your body bloats, your blood vessels burst and stuff, and you are physically dead.
Is there
a Wolverine-like healing factor?
You can take damage, but you recover quickly?
And is scar tissue the only thing that shows? Like, if it's internal organs rupturing, that doesn't count?
I don't know.
I mean, anyway. they may not even be in there. He may just be an empty carcass full of immortality.
Immortality sack. So his sad sack face leaning against the rock fades into a mural of the Mona Lisa on the side of a building in 1985.
That was a good dissolve.
Another great transition.
Yeah, this is, so far they've all been aces. We're into it. We see McLeod still wearing his goofy ass outfit from the night before, with what looks like now longer hair. And he's blearily walking down the sidewalk in Chelsea. And he rolls up to a very, very nice looking building with R. Nash Antiques painted on the windows, and lets himself into a very swanky office/apartment situation. Upstairs in his apartment, he grabs a drink, opens a set of doors, and walks into a very strangely appointed round room with a stained glass skylight surrounded by artifacts from various cultures. We see Greek, Asian, Phoenician.
It almost seemed like his battle trophies, though. It was like a lot of war, like war memorabilia.
Yeah.
That split level couch situation, too.
Yeah.
Like the horseshoe. Like, I would, that
it seemed like a place where orgies happen. Let's just call it let's call it what it is.
With so many weapons around, that seems pokey and dangerous.
So he sits with that same dopey, frustrated look on his face, and we hear the sound of a bell or some such thing, metal on metal, and we cut right to a blacksmith in a kilt working on a horseshoe. It seems we've jumped back in time again, and we see that it's Connor. Connor McLeod has become unstuck in time, my friends.
Oh, yeah.
Slaughterhouse well, I like, Five, that's Billy
the
Pilgrim.
One, that's one of the good things about this movie is the time jumps.
Yeah. I think it's what makes this movie super interesting.
Yes.
It's sort of like, unique. It feels like Time Bandits, like another movie with Sean Connery. Interestingly.
Ooh, yeah.
So a pan up shows us that the blacksmith is McLeod, who's taken up residence at a different Scottish castle.
Which is was the castle under construction or what?
It's just a very small,
it was cool I feel like looking.
Like a countryside fortification. It was supposed to be just probably a watchtower for that part of the world. So we see a blonde woman, Heather, exit the very narrow tower and walk over to the blacksmith shed.
The tower seemed real. When I saw the wide shot, I'm like, that's a map painting. Then you see the close-ups, and you're like, did they build this thing? Or does this exist in Scotland somewhere?
It looks legit to me.
Yeah.
We should mention it's 1541 now. I don't know if that's ever mentioned in the film, but it's 5 years have passed.
Yeah, he mentions it later on that it's been 5 years.
Okay.
Yep.
Or Ramirez does. Someone mentions it shortly. But anyway, yeah. So Heather comes out, and she's like, hey, do you want some pie and ale? He's like, what kind of pie are we talking about? Yeah.
That's the dream. A simple life, a beautiful woman offering you pie and ale.
Yeah, Heather's hot.
He picks her up, embraces, they laugh, they kiss. He dunks his head in a barrel of water to wash himself.
Disgusting. That's their drinking water. That's 100% their drinking water.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like,
and he just put his lice riddle head right into it.
She had just said oh, you're filthy. And he's let me contaminate our water here.
Yeah. This is fine. Cut to them having just made it next to some rocks while fully clothed.
Fully clothed sex. If you're doing it outdoors, though, that may be
cold. Kilt on kilt, you're fine.
Yeah, just lift a skirt.
Yeah, you have access at both ends.
And you're keeping the top half warm.
Yeah.
You're preserving circulation. So she says, we can bone forever if you want. And he's like, I want that. So they start to kiss again, and then suddenly a man on a horse jumps directly over them. The camera pans up to reveal Sean Connery, and I'm like, the only thing that I know about this movie is that Sean Connery is in it. And I'm like, finally, where have you been for the first 35 minutes of this movie?
He showed up like the most swashbuckling cock blocker ever.
Yeah, he is looking swashbuckling as shit.
Yep. Well, and he waited. He's been watching for a while. You know it.
Yeah,
He's been out there being like, oh.
Cranked one out.
I'm going to get a good view.
He's going 5, 4, 3, 2. Hi-ya!
He's decked out like floppy hat covered in peacock feathers.
Gold trimmed crimson like velvet doublet with peacock feathers everywhere and a pearl earring.
A dangling earring.
So he greets them, introduces himself as Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, chief metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain. And he's like, I'm at your service. The Amazon went through the trouble of telling us that he was only known as Charles V in Germany, and that in Spain he would have been Charles I.
Interesting.
Charles is not a very Spanish name either. He would have been Carlos.
He's like King Juan Carlos or something like that.
Was a long way from home, though, Ramirez.
Right? So they're both like, the fuck? McLeod's like, what do you want? Ramirez points and tells him, you. And then smiles that fucking Sean Connery fucking smile that makes people absolutely swoon and drop their panties. Like that look on his face, I'm like, man, that is a handsome man.
I was reading about how hard Connery had worked on his Spanish accent, and I'm like, what?
What?
No.
What Spanish accent?
What? Was what you read that he did not work hard on it?
He sounds the most Scottish he's ever sounded in anything.
I'm like, he sounds like Sean Connery.
I mean,
that's insane. Well, I did not read that, and that is like, nuts.
Okay, Spanish, sure.
As an avid listener to the podcast, there are many moments where I've heard you gentlemen talk about how screenwriters would change lines or change plot points to better suit Arnold, whether there was no romantic chemistry or he couldn't mumble out a bunch of vowels and consonants in the right order, and so they just make it whatever he needed it to be. This seems like one of those opportunities where they should have made him any other, like, you know, the Kurgan is a people that was like ancient that doesn't exist.
Right. Totally.
Why not give him an origin story that does not link him directly to a people that we know with an accent we know? Like, anything could have been fine.
I think it's probably to avoid too many Scotsmen is the thing. Is like, we've already got a Highlander, but then, like,
it's about to get more weird, well, actually, I'm from Egypt.
Yeah, fuck it.
Like, what?
What if they had, and just hear me out, called it the Templar and made, because it would have been perfectly plausible for Christopher Lambert with that voice to be Teutonic.
Sure.
To be an ancient Templar and just call it the Templar. They would have rallied a lot more right-wing crazies to the cause of this movie. But then make Connery the Highlander.
We ain't changing the title now.
Right.
But wouldn't the Templar sounds pretty cool too, but not as cool as the Highlander.
Yeah, I don't know. But you said too many Scotsmen, and that is a sitcom I totally would watch if we can get that greenlit.
Ramirez dismounts, a storm's a-brewing. He says he knows who McCloud is and what's happened to him. He also lets us know that McCloud's been on the lam for 5 years. Lightning strikes and McCloud doubles over in pain for no reason whatsoever.
It's like a disturbance in the force.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So McCloud tells Heather to get inside.
That was weird.
Yeah.
Get inside, woman. And he got a little rough with her.
Yeah. Well, like, the way that he communicates with women is not at all like,
he went like abusive boyfriend mode, I feel like.
So we cut to McCloud now standing solo on the hillside and being struck by lightning several times.
Was that supposed to be a straight cut, or was that like a time lapse?
I feel like it's supposed to be that moment, but he's,
I thought,
like,
so too. There was just no coherence in the editing.
No, none at all. So he's like crying out, but is otherwise unharmed. Ramirez is like, the sensation you're feeling is called the quickening.
But like, I don't understand here. It's not the quickening. Like, did somebody just get beheaded and it just so happened to be the time that Ramirez shows up?
But Ramirez didn't tell him. It's verbatim. It's like, this is the quickening.
Yeah, he says, this is the quickening.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, there's so many weird things that happen in this thing that don't seem to align with the other lore of this story of, like, you get the power when you chop somebody else's head off.
Right.
But, like, are they just assuming some power? Otherwise, he's just a man on a cliff being struck by lightning.
Right, exactly. It's like no battle's been fought, and it's like, I don't know what's supposed to, like, yeah. So McCloud's like, hey, who are you? And Ramirez is like, we're the shame. We're brothers.
We're brothers.
So hard cut back to New York in the 80s. Action picks up in Brenda's precinct. She walks into Frank's office area where Frank's hanging up from a call in which a guy says that his Vietnamese brother or Vietnamese neighbor is eating a dog.
It was fucking weirdly racist.
Yeah, it's like very strange racism.
Also, isn't this Lieutenant Frank? He's like a homicide detective, right? He wouldn't. Yeah. That's not his beat, dog eating neighbors.
No. So, yeah, like, he wouldn't be answering the phone.
It's just
calls.
Weird.
All the cops are pieces of shit in this movie.
Yeah. Brenda starts like riffling through a file on Frank's desk, which he takes from her. It's like, hey, that's confidential. And he's like, how are things going down in forensics? And she says, that shit's dull, and asks if they can go grab lunch. And he's like, only if you're buying. And she's like, yeah, I'm buying. He's like, done. So as they're walking out, she's like, oh shit, I forgot my purse. And he's like, I'll meet you outside. And she goes straight to his desk, opens the file on the Fazil murder case that's just lying on his desk.
Right.
And she sees, looks forever at McCloud's mugshot.
There would be no mugshot. Yeah. He wasn't processed and arrested.
I don't know.
He's got the 8x10 glossy headshots.
Two directions.
McCloud / Nash or whatever in there. Where do you even get those?
I don't know. So
maybe those are headshots. Maybe he's looking to start acting on the side.
We already know. He's got free time. He can only make that face. That's his resting face. So we cut back over to Nash Antiques where McCloud's sharpening his katana.
How is the sharpening technique? Was it better than
it's
the
It's better
the
than
ones
that we've seen just because he's sort of like going all the way up the blade.
Okay.
Again, the apartment is fucking sick. That place costs $10 million or more nowadays.
Yes,
probably.
Indeed.
20
it's like
million.
20-foot ceilings.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
it's amazing.
And several floors. He takes a break from the sword to pick up a book lying next to him on the couch titled A Metallurgical History of Ancient Sword Making, which is a great title. The thick-ass book. He flips it over, and lo and behold, Brenda J. Wyatt from Forensics is the author.
She's the foremost expert in the field.
Yep. This some shit, you guys.
nobody bought that book, so she had to get a real job.
Oh, my God.
She also, she looked a lot more stylish and attractive on the dust jacket
You have to go out and get the professional headshots.
They really primp you up, send you to a glamour shot studio.
So McCloud sets the book down and has this very amused look on his face as if he cannot believe his luck that the forensics expert working on his case is also an expert in ancient swords and shit.
That's totally normal.
Yeah. I was just reading this.
I love this book.
I have an extensive library.
That's why he followed her. He was like, I recognize you. How do I know you? Oh, yeah.
I've read this book several times.
My metallurgy book.
Yeah. As he grins like an idiot, we hear a Connery voiceover. Sometimes, McCloud, the sharpest blade is not enough.
Also, did you notice how dirty his fucking fish tank was? Yeah, That's all I can notice. You really should take better care of those fish.
McCloud looks back at his nasty fish tank, and we get a transition to a lock in Scotland where Ramirez is teaching McCloud via the Miyagi method of balance by having him stand up on that rowboat, son. McCloud tells Ramirez that he looks like a woman and calls him a stupid haggis.
It's weird.
Ramirez is like, what's haggis? Which is great coming from a Scottish person.
Yes.
McCloud tells him what haggis is, and Ramirez is like, that sounds nasty. Then lets out a sneeze, which rocks the boat, and McCloud freaks out because he apparently can't swim. Then he calls Ramirez a Spanish peacock, but Ramirez is like, hey, I'm Egyptian, which I'm like, the fuck is happening in this in this movie?
Connery looks even less Egyptian than he does Spanish, you know?
Well, so I will say he's Spanish in that he is the metallurgist for the king and has a Spanish name.
He never said he was from Spain.
Yeah.
That's also true. So McCloud says that, hey, I thought you said you were from Spain, and like calls him a liar. And then Ramirez berates McCloud, telling him that he knows shit and even less about his own potential. So then he flips McCloud out of the boat. McCloud screams like a wuss. He's like, I'm drowning. Ramirez rows away from the drowning. McCloud's like,
yeah,
you can't drown because you're immortal.
So he's also starts singing some type of like hymn.
I wish he'd started singing
Connery did.
Farewell and adieu, are you dear Spanish ladies.
That was a banger at the time.
Probably.
So I don't like that the Highlander cannot swim, that McCloud can't swim, because we know that he came from one city that was on an island in the middle of a lake, and now he is lakeside. He's got free time, I'm sure.
Yeah.
He's got a bathe.
TV back then. You got nothing to do but learn how to swim.
He probably would have figured it out.
Right. So at the bottom of the lake, McCloud realizes that he is not, in fact, drowning and that he can breathe underwater. He laughs, for some reason, draws his sword with a mind to hack Ramirez in two, and then probably 45 minutes to an hour later, walking across the bottom of the lake, resurfaces just behind Ramirez, who's had enough time
like
to row ashore and
he's
build.
He's covered in shit.
Yeah, Ramirez has had time to row ashore, build a fire that has had time to like collapse a little bit.
It's a weird sequence. This whole thing is weird. He's like tangled in the seaweed.
Yeah. McCloud approaches quietly, sword drawn. We guess to kill Ramirez.
I'm gonna kill this fuck.
Yeah. So he takes a big, and this is, again, and this may be the first time that I'll mention it, but a big two-handed downward strike. This is the first of probably two dozen two-handed downward strikes that we get in this movie, which none of which, I think maybe one of them in the whole movie lands. One of them finds purchase. But anyway, this one lands in a log that Ramirez has been sitting on. How did Ramirez disappear?
Yeah, it's the quickening.
Apparate.
What is it?
I don't know. Yeah,
is that how it works? Yeah, he apparated.
He can move like a fucking Jedi.
So he then he like stops real quick because he feels a blade on the back of his neck, and it's Ramirez holding that familiar katana that we saw in the first act.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells McCloud, you're both crude and slow, and that your attack was no better than that of a clumsy child.
So I read where, like, apparently Connery was drunk.
I hope so.
Most of the time. Like, they said he was drinking this homemade scotch.
That's badass.
And that he was, like, just having a blast working in Scotland or whatever and was just staying drunk the time.
Man, I hope that's true.
I think so, too. But even drunk, Connery's, like, acting circles around Lambert. who's yeah. just trash.
I kind of hope that he has his own scotch and he calls it Scotchery.
Sean Scotchery.
I'm going to drink some Scotchery. See you later. I'll be in my trailer.
Yeah, I know he filmed his entire appearance in this movie that was filmed in 1 week, which I think also explains like
some how of it was in Wales and some of it was in Scotland.
Continuity disasters because yeah. it's just like we just got to fucking crank these shots out.
Some of this was filmed. Some of this part of it was filmed in Snowdonia National Park in Wales.
That's amazing. Yeah, it looked amazing. Which I will be visiting amazing.
In November.
Sweet. Yeah,
yeah. I'll be right in on, Snowdonia in 2 months. So anyway. Yeah, Ramirez is holding the blade, tells him you're a fucking idiot, and then he disarms McLeod with a single swipe of his wrist, sending this that broadsword, the McLeod family's broadsword, flying through the air. McLeod's like, all this is the work of the devil, while fish drop out of his kilt.
That was a weird edit. I feel like that's the editor like trying to stitch together action it's, that doesn't make sense.
That like parts of this movie, and we've discussed it in movies past, where it's like, I'm going to try for a comedic moment to break up.
But now is not the time, like in the middle of the dialogue.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Ramirez says again that, hey, buddy, you can't die and that you should just accept it. And McLeod's like, heh, heh, heh. Then stops abruptly and tells Ramirez, like, I hate you. I also love the I hate you school of teaching, which you identified as being from.
Over the top.
Yeah,
from over the top. Yeah. Well, it's a start. It's a start.
Mm-hmm. Canon School of Film Writing. So anyway, yeah. Ramirez says that hate's a perfect place to start. And that, friends, man, that was a marathon
that
episode.
That was an epic.
Yeah, so much happens.
And we've learned next to nothing about what it means to be an immortal still.
No.
And we will not.
Yeah, and we won't.
We will not.
And that won't change for the duration of the movie. But
all right.
We've gotten some backstory at least. But that's about all we've got.
That's all I've got.
And we introduced to Sean Connery.
Thank Christ.
Yeah,
here's
right?
you to save the movie.
Oh, man. Anyway, we have to leave you here because we need refill. Do we have one more in us?
I'm up for it.
We'll discuss. We're going to pour ourselves another drink and discuss if we're going to be right back. But in the meantime, we'll be back.